I didn't know if that was you or me that dropped.
I'm not sure.
Our phone service sucks here.
Oh, does it?
Terrible.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I was just speaking briefly about Lee Michaels and Frosty, the drummer that went on to play out of Austin quite a bit before he recently died. But I had no idea what Lee Michaels. For some reason, I was just thinking of him. But so you're saying after you'd wrapped up in that small Center for the Arts up there?
Yeah. And that was another deal. I mean, I got Joanne on the payroll, and you know, she and I were working that at a beer garden down in the basement where we could serve beer, and it wasn't much money, but it kept a big group of us eating and having a great time. It had a floating herringbone, and that was a real value to that facility. It had the original wood herringbone floating floor in there. It was beautiful. And so we got all that refinished and it was a historical site too. I think, you know, I think where it is now, I don't know if we ever got it all the way back then, but so then then it just kind of petered out and I had to make some money because I had other mouths to feed, and it just wasn't happening in Oregon. Mm-hmm. That's when I came back home here, and
which is Houston, right?
Went to work for the Houston Grand Opera, which was like 180 degrees from what I was doing up there. Hmm. Except that we're still doing the same kind of entertaining. You know, I got to meet a bunch of the big opera stars and hang out with them. I was Leonard Bernstein's runner, his alcohol runner. I'd go to Specs, which is the big liquor store here, and buying his, he drank 15, 20 year scotch. And I was the one who'd run, you know, go kind of at his beck and call some. Mm-hmm. But Placido Domingo and all those guys. So I got to do that, but mostly I was raising money. I was in a development position. And I went into that, and then it was pretty much freelancing after I did my stint there. I was there about 5 years. So then the latter half of the 80s,
when you say freelancing,
kind of doing stuff on my own. I managed this one guy and just kind of doing whatever I could. Ended up working at Compaq. And at that, when I was at Compaq, is when Phil called and said, "You got to come over here." Lawrence, I've fired Lawrence. I have nothing to do with him anymore. You know, you got to come over here. Just try it out for a month or two. So that's when I fell into the bus business.
What was that, the business called then?
It was Custom Coach West, but it was I own the company now. Phil Gabe passed it on to me, whatever that's worth, but I still own the corporation, which is Bus Brokerage Inc.
That's what I remember. Yeah.
Okay. Bus Brokerage Incorporated. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, a corporation in good standing in the state of California. I don't know what I can do with it. But every once in a while, I get some mail. But that was crazy. God, that was a crazy first 5 years were just nuts. That was insane.
Well, then that's where you and I met after you were up and running with Phil out in L.A., Custom Coach West. And I know you guys would turn to me off and on for aircraft quotes.
I remember we mentioned this last time we spoke. I remember meeting you. I think we probably had a bus. Most of the time we did try and find a bus, cruise around if we were going out to do anything. And you were there with the guy who does the air shows. He was the promoter, who produced the air show.
I think you're speaking of the guy. I think his first name was Ken.
He was like out of Wings Over Houston or winged over.
That was out of Illinois somewhere.
Huh.
Jeez, I don't know. Now that I'm thinking about it, I can't even remember which one that was, because there was a couple of air show guys I got involved with. But, well, that's it. Where did we, what area, do you remember where that was?
I remember we got into the, we were all on the bus. We went somewhere. I imagine we went to a show, went out to dinner, and I don't remember all the details of that night.
You think it was tied into one of those performance magazine or those conferences that we used to go to?
That could be it.
Yeah, I wonder if that's it or not.
That's like probably it.
Palm Springs or something.
They had one up in like Northridge or somewhere up there. There's a golf course, because I remember everybody playing golf on that golf course.
Because I
do remember. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I know Jerry Calhoun flew in. I know he was there because I drove him around a couple of times.
I remember I was in one of the foursomes, and I was the third to hit the ball, or I was the last to hit the ball. And a guy, I don't know who I was playing with, obviously industry guys, but
yep.
One guy sprayed it left, one guy sprayed it right, another guy chunked it, and I'm up there going, oh, fuck. And it was one of the best balls I've hit in all year, It's like, holy shit, everybody looks at me going, whoa, are you a pro?
Duffer.
I know, I got fucking lucky.
And what's your, you got a 23 handicap? Yeah. Okay.
I play scratch. Yeah, I think
I
had my terrible moments after that, but it was just one of those, wow, I actually got off the first tee and hit a good ball.
Oh, off the first tee. Everybody's like, oh, no, here we go.
Everybody's standing around. Who's Loft? Who's this Lofton guy? He flies the Grateful Dead. That's
yeah, really.
No, Or he flies. Oh, I think it's mostly Jimmy Buffett and back in those days. Hart.
Did you talk? You flew Hart?
Yeah, 14 years.
Mike DeRozier. My buddy. Yeah,
but I mostly dealt.
You remember
him? I mostly dealt with Dick Adams, the road manager.
Yeah. Right.
And the of course, the attorney, the back end stuff, the attorneys and the CPAs.
Sure.
That's usually who we dealt with. Management, Mike, as you well know, the insulator to the manager was usually the tour or the road manager that you go through.
Right. Yep.
And Dick Adams was the one that I spent most of my time with. Trying to remember when I started Hart. It was somewhere around, when did they break their album? Do you know? It was shortly after that. It wasn't too much longer after that.
70, had to be like early 70s. You mean the Mushroom Records, the one Mushroom Record?
No, the major, one after that was I can't remember. Oh.
Dog and Butterfly?
Yeah, that's it,
Okay. That's like, 70s. I think, 75.
Oh, okay.
76, somewhere in there, I would think.
Yeah, so I actually didn't pick them up, I think, until late 70s, early 80s. But I remember about that time MTV was coming in.
Right.
And I remember talking to Dick Adams about that, going, well, I guess I'm screwed in the transportation world. Everybody's just going to be watching it on TVs going, no, Michael, it's the other way around. MTV's going to make touring even more popular.
It's going to go berserk the other direction. Right.
Yeah, I was kind of semi-freaked out, like going, I got to find something else to do. I can't fly entertainers anymore. They're all going to be on MTV.
Little did you know.
So, we're coming back to when we met and with the air show thing. I wonder, I can't remember.
That was probably 90. It was probably 91, 92 when we, because I'll remember this. One of my first jobs was to get rid of all of Phillip's horses. And that was an order from his mother.
Give up all of his
money. You need to get rid of all of Philip's horses because he's wasting all his money. The horses. So that was my first job. I mean, I don't think he ever did. Well, yeah, I think there was one horse, Latham. I'm trying to remember. That was the only horse, the name I could remember, because that was a horse I usually rode. And I think he held on to that. I don't ever remember that horse going, but all the other ones went. I mean, what do you have, like 7 or 8? Maybe more?
Well, that's interesting, because we must have known each other before the 90s, because I moved to Durango in 88, something like that.
Really?
And I was still in Big Bear when Phil, and I don't know how we started up the conversation, but he found out that, you know, my ex-wife, Sunshine, had a horse.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. he says, well, I've got a thoroughbred, and he says, do you mm-hmm. want it? And I don't know what it was, something like, you pay for the gas to get me up there and I'll give it to you or something. I don't know what it was, something like that.
Hmm.
No, it was an Arabian. No, we already had the thoroughbred.
They're Arabians, yeah.
Yeah.
They were all Arabians.
Yeah, and it was Egyptian mm-hmm. Arabian. I remember he had the registration on it, the certificate. He gave it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And Buzz, it had a weird name, Buzzarino or something like that. Bazzotti something, some Arab Egyptian kind of
Arab name.
And so he ended up coming up, and I thought you were with him at the time. Did you remember coming up to Big Bear?
I did not go to Big. No, I never went. I went up there, but it was after you were gone, I'm sure.
Okay.
Actually, I never went to Big Bear. I went to Arrowhead.
Arrowhead.
Only place I'd been up there. In the mountains back behind San Bernardino.
And I lived in Crestline too, which was right down the street from Lake Arrowhead. So.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Wow.
Went from Crestline to Big Bear. And I remember Phil coming up delivering the horse, Buzzarino, and, you know, my ex, we had that horse, the two horses, the thoroughbred and the Egyptian Arab, Buzz, and we had that until just recently he passed, Bobby.
What?
Yeah, he lived almost 28 years or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
He had a good life. He was out in Colorado, you know.
Yeah.
For most of his life. And light trail horse, and mostly pasteurizing and some good growing hay.
Good hay. That's amazing. I remember that happening because I remember Phil telling me. Here, I already got rid of this one. So I did come a couple of years after.
Okay.
And I think you had already moved away.
Okay.
But then once I met you and I found out you lived in Durango, it's like, oh my God, you know, at that time, back then we used to go up there a lot.
Yeah. Cause you had your cousin, was it, or something in Grand Junction or something like that?
Joanne's brother.
Oh, in Durango. Somebody was in Durango.
In Bayfield.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, he lived in Durango for a while. Leon, or second
That's
oldest
what I
brother.
Remember. Yep.
Lee and Rosie lived in Durango. Then they moved out to Bayfield. They bought a house out in Bayfield.
That's right. Yeah, because I remember meeting them at one of the parades in town.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So.
Oh man,
what I'm doing, I'm trying to figure out, which would probably help you with your book too, is, and I hope you don't mind, I've been recording this, by the way. I figured.
Oh, there was a little incriminating stuff, but
no. I figured none
no,
of
I'm
this
just
is going to edit out anything that's not appropriate for any of us.
I'm not
worried. I'm trying to figure out how to approach because my book is going to be mostly kind of obviously airplane slanted, and what takes place in and around the transportation side of flying big entertainers, right? So I started thinking about, well, okay, I could talk about the airplane. I could do some wiki references. I could talk about the quirkiness of the plane. So it kind of helps from the aviation, the aviator side would find some intrigue or interest in it also. And then also from the entertainment side, talking about what would make this reader, I mean, for the most part, I'm doing this book, I think, kind of for what you talked about doing it, and that would be for the grandkids. You know, what did grandpa do, really? You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But if you can put it together in such a way that it becomes an interesting both stories, which we have plenty of stories, talking about a particular entertainer or entertainers, how it reflected at the same time with the transportation side, which was the business you were in. So questions that I would ask you, first I would ask you, what does your normal, you know, like somebody you're talking to in a bar and stuff, what do they normally ask you when they find out that you bust, you know, the most famous entertainers in the world for many years? Are they looking for, well, is the entertainer, you know, is he like he appears to be? Or are they even interested in some road stories?
Yeah, I would think, and I don't really know, or most people would be completely shocked to, and most people have that I was even in this business at all. I mean, the people who knew that I was in the business already knew everything. I mean, we would go out to shows. I mean, I must have gotten, you know, several hundred people backstage. Some of the same people 2, 3, 5 times, maybe 500. I don't know. So they didn't, you know, back then oh wow, this is what you do. Okay. You know, now it's people are surprised to hear that I was doing this, and I really don't talk about it. I know, just go about my day. Most
Same
people don't know anything about it.
Same
I've just
me.
Begun to put stuff on Facebook.
Yeah.
And sometimes I regret doing that, but certain things strike me and I will. So nobody really does ask. I don't know. I guess I've had a few people come up to me and ask, oh yeah, did you ever know this? Did you know this guy? And, how are these people? You remember working with them? So I don't know.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question then. From the angle of the curious reader or listener out there, how does one even find a tour? And what is it you do to put a tour together? I mean, before it even goes out.
Right. You know, I mean, I had my list that performance management. Remember the management book?
Mm-hmm.
The performance used to generate. I mean, that was my Bible.
I used to talk about tours that they were considering.
Well, no, I would just cold call. A lot of times I'd be cold calling. I mean, it's a rhythm. The touring back then, I'm sure it still is. It was a rhythm. Right at the first of the year, all the rap tours went out.
Okay.
You know, and a lot of the soul and, you know, like the OJs and those kind of bands would tour the same kind of time. So, you know, so I'd be working on those in the fall. And then didn't even, you know, cause that was the only time we would have to. Because we quit marketing in, you know, by springtime, by late spring, if all the buses weren't booked out for the summer, you're screwed. You know, you better really get your ass in gear. So it all kind of went by itself then. The only time we had to really start working was in the fall to keep tours going, get to, you know, a lot of the tours were ending. at the, you know, right at the end of the year, December was always pretty dead.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of it. The other part of it was the geography. You know, a lot of times I would, being in LA, or at least they thought we were in LA, they would call us for the, people would go up and down the coast.
Right.
In the winter. Yeah, they'd be a little one-off tour, you know, a couple of short tours up and down there. So the marketing changed from, you know, landing that giant, you know, 6-bus tour to just keeping each individual bus kind of moving every, you know, at least a few times a month during the slow period.
Right. Now, but I assume you strategized over time and had your buses spread out over the country.
Well, yeah.
Maybe end a tour somewhere and then just go ahead and keep the bus there maybe for a while and before you.
We could do that. We were parking buses certain places, like, you know, trying to, Jerry, you know, of course, Jerry Calhoun was the biggest source, because the guy had, you know, 150 buses or whatever. So, you know, if we could keep 40, 50 of his buses working year round, that was our main priority, and then filled in with the small time owners with their equipment.
Right.
But, you know, of course, Jerry, you know, he wanted all his equipment at the ranch pretty much. As he began to trust me a little bit, he would allow me to keep a bus. I used to keep buses here. Mm-hmm. You know, up here in Montgomery, you used to park them up here, mm-hmm. And be able to run them, you know, short things around here. So, yeah, you know, the marketing is really kind of a month-on-month basis. You know your slow times, and, you know, in the other times, nobody can get a bus. There are no buses available.
Well, and I assume you experienced the same thing I did in the aviation side, where you go a few years and it'd strictly be word of mouth, and you wouldn't have to do a lot of on the ground marketing. And then some other years I'd end up having, I don't know, 20, you know, airplane brokers all of a sudden in the business.
Right.
And so now you're it's like you're on the phone going, well, who's this guy that just gave me a quote for like dirt cheap? And I go, well, he probably is going to put you in a dirt cheap airplane. I don't know. What do you want to do?
The Leonard Skinner.
Well, it's like I told you that deal with Ricky Nelson. I forget who.
Oh,
the tour manager.
Yeah, you turned
was.
Him down.
Yeah, he ended up calling me sometime in October, November for a late winter tour. And he says, well, I got to, you know, word of mouth, as you well know, was a big part of this business.
Oh, yeah.
But he would call and he says, oh, yeah, such and such from Frontline Management. It might have been Irving Azoff or Howard Kaufman or any of those guys. And they recommended you, so I, you know, I'm calling you, but here's what I need. And, you know, he wanted a DC-3, and I said, well, I don't do piston engines anymore. And he goes, well, what are you talking about? I go, I just don't put my clients in piston engines anymore. The safety factor is too slim, and if you lose an engine, I'd rather you be in a twin turbine or four-engine turbine or twin turbojet or fan jet instead of a piston twin and like the old whatever DC threes, fours, just on and on. But so he goes, well, so what's that going to cost me? And I go, well, it's going to be more. He says, well, I can't do it. You got to give me the same price as this DC-3. I think it was a DC-3. It wasn't a Beach 18. It was a DC-3. And he goes, well, I don't think we're going to do any business. And I go, well, I hate to miss out on it, but I just can't. I mean, I could have, Bobby, quoted him a, you know, piston twin if I was didn't stick to my guns. But it was just one of those things that I'm curious to hear your take dealing with some of the buses too. If you, you know, were put up against, you know, trying to quote out some cheaper, older bus just to get the tour? Or did you hold your guns maybe sometimes and say, look, we got it, you know, this is better equipment, it's safer, it's more up to date, we'd rather quote you in this? Anyway, when it came to Ricky Nelson, I think it was New Year's Eve or somewhere around there, they got a call from a friend of mine down the street I actually played poker with, and he goes, what about that Ricky, huh? That's kind of a bummer. And I go, what happened? Oh, you didn't hear? He just, you know, just barreled in his airplane. And sure shit, it was the same plane he wanted me to put him in. And I refused to do it. I don't know if, you know, obviously synchronicity is something to be pondered upon, but whether or not that could have happened, and even if I put him in one of my planes, which I never had an episode like that, but it was just weird, you know, thinking, well, I just finished talking to this guy a month earlier, turning him down because he wanted me to put him in the same plane he ended up augering in. And then I subsequently followed up on that with talking to, I remember flying into Fullerton Airport, because I made an arrangement, because I was so curious about what the heck happened on that plane. And you know, that whole thing, they started talking about freebasing, and that's what started the fire and all that. And I ended up meeting with the Nelson's attorney, and he gave me the lowdown about what was going on the QT during the trial. And he actually was showing me paperwork about how that plane just got out of an annual inspection, a yearly inspection, and apparently the lock nut on the combustion burner for the internal heat for the, you know, heating the cabin was loose, wasn't tightened down, wasn't torqued correctly, and it actually, at a certain altitude, worked itself loose and was just spewing gas and caught fire. So, and then later on, I collected.
Did it know whether it was on fire or not, though?
Apparently it was burning it filled the cabin with smoke, and that's when they had to ditch the airplane, and that's where they ended up, you know, basically crashing the thing. I guess the two pilots got out the front and a couple of other people, but that was
out the windows. Yeah.
And I'm here again, not totally recollecting the exactness of it, but this is part of the book I'm thinking to do, is go ahead and incorporate some of the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, which is, they only get involved when there's death involved with aircraft accidents, and they do a follow-up synopsis. And so I ordered all these final disposition documentation from the Federal Aviation National Transportation Safety Board, and I've got a box of all the entertainment touring crashes.
Oh, wow.
Including Leonard Skinner, Stevie Ray Vaughan in the helicopter, and Ricky Nelson. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about doing some sort of a reference, since a tight end is part of my experience, if there's a story there.
Definitely do that. That's good.
Yeah, to bring that in. I mean, there's a little bit of morbidness.
Buddy Holly.
What's
Buddy
that?
Holly.
Buddy Holly. Yeah. So I thought I would try to tie those in as part of the storyline, looping it through this particular book. See how that goes. Because I, you know, the Leonard Skinner story kind of tied into me and Jimmy Buffett. There was a big storyline there. Leonard Skinner also tied in with me flying the crew for Nazareth. Because they were the ones that just got off the plane the day before Leonard Skinner went down, because they, the crew members, at least what they told me, they said, I mean, the vibe was so heavy. It was like something was telling us, either get off or you're going to die. It was like, what was that? So,
yikes.
Yeah, it was kind of trippy. So I was just kind of curious, did you What kind of story relationships, because I know you had plenty, that you found yourself...
Gosh, yeah.
Go, oh, yeah, well, that was odd.
I mean, we had some... Yeah, you know, yeah, there was a bunch of them, like the... I remember the band Black Eyed Peas were going across Pennsylvania. What is that, I-90? Across across the northern part of the state. And they got, the bus got stuck. The snow kept coming down, getting deeper and deeper, and the bus couldn't go any further. And the road, the freeway was closed. And they were out in the middle of nowhere. There was just nothing there. And so the driver calls me, and finally, then it's like all day we're talking back and forth. And the band, I talked to, I forgot who my contact was out there, but I'm also the couple of the band guys. And what they did is, you know, there were people out there freezing, you know, their cars were off, or whatever. So they started letting people that were on the freeway, you know, onto the bus that didn't have heat in their cars. So the bus became kind of a, and the, you know, they're getting on the bus, and it's like the Black Eyed Peas. That's, you know, I mean, little things like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
The only thing, the ones that always stick out in my mind, is all the problems that the people that we had to pull off into the rest area out in the middle of nowhere because the accountant's not paying.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah.
So
we had to do that a lot,
wow.
Or too often. And then another time, oh gosh, who's the drummer of Motley Crue's drummer? And he was married to the.
Oh, yeah.
What's her name?
Yeah.
Well, they rented a bus. They went. It was for Tommy Lee's.
Tommy Lee. Yeah.
Birthday party. They lived out in Agora, kind of out in, yeah, it was Agora, the south of the freeway down in there. And so they wanted to surprise, it was a surprise party. All the people were going to be on the bus and come drive in, you know, to the house, and the party would begin. So my driver calls old Louis Vaez. He's like, she's wanting me to drive this bus through where I know it's going to get all scratched up on both sides. There's no way I can avoid it. Tried everything. I said, then she's going to have to, you know, tell her she's got to put some money up to, you know, to refinish the outside, you know, $1,500 at least, $2,000, whatever, take the scratches out. Well, she and him start fighting. So I said, get her on the phone. Let me talk to her. And I talked to her. I said, it's not going to move unless you get your CPA. And I forgot who was, call me and agree. We're at least going to do that because it was late. And she did. She got him to call, and I said, you know, it could be as much as $2,500 to take all these scratches out. And it hadn't been done yet. So you tell me if you're going to, you know, had to work that out with them. And so the party did go on, but she didn't like me, whatever her name is. The Baywatch girl.
Yeah, you probably didn't watch a bunch of Baywatch anyway. So.
Nope. Well, I can't remember ever seeing one episode all the way through.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway, so you know, some of the, if I could, there's a bunch of those. Oh gosh, and that I'll remember when I start going through. Like we in our office we had a little NCR papered message books.
Uh-huh.
And we were just, you know, because those save this many times you lose a phone number and we could always go back to it. So I have all of those. And I know that those are going to be the source of a lot of good stories.
Yeah.
That I've forgotten.
Uh-huh.
You know.
So just to spend a few more moments with you, and then let's pick this up another time. We catch a breath
another
week or something. But
more
for the production side. So you'd get a call from a tour manager, right? Road manager.
Mm-hmm. Maybe initially, if it was their first go with us, it would generally always be the tour manager. And then subsequently, I dealt with the production manager.
Right. So they would tell me if it aligns with the same thing I did on the aircraft side. You would talk to them a little bit about what their requirements were, where they're going to pick up the tour and where they're going to finish up the tour, and then requirements about how many were, for me, it'd be seats on the plane on average. I know that was kind of a tough issue for me because I would be dealing with aircraft that would just be shy, you know, one or two seats, and you couldn't use the airplane because the or you would have to convince the tour manager or the road manager to actually dump a couple people that they thought that were essential that all of a sudden became unessential. But
right.
You were kind of – you're dealing with – because I was dealing mostly now in the bands. You're dealing both with the bands and the crews.
Mm-hmm.
So did you deal with that same issue with the crew? You had a set – of course, they had a set crew that was pretty
ours
much –
ours were bunks, of course. You know, they were sleeping bunks because that's the main use of the – Or the you know, the close that, you know, of course, getting from city to city, but, you know, the guys, if the crew has got to have has got to sleep during that drive if they're doing back to back shows.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're going to be worthless the next day.
So it seems like the crew situation was even more vital than almost the band because the crew had a certain amount of people on the entourage that had to get there, and they were the ones that needed bunks to sleep. So you knew pretty much from the start how many bunks you had to provide.
Right.
Now, for the band, they were you're dealing with, well, are all these wives essential? Are all these girlfriends essential? You know, because you had so many bunks.
You're going to find more on the road, so can't you just leave these?
So did
you really want them out there?
Yeah, the same. It sounds like you're running in the same sort of a situation. You have an 8-bunk or 12-bunk, and you're trying to sell the 8-bunk, but then the band's kind of going, well, we need 10 bunks. And you have to kind of talk to them a little bit. You're going, well, are these essential people, or are these people that you can make? If this works for you from a fiduciary, you know, money standpoint, can you live with the 8-bunk? And then all of a sudden they're getting back to you like, yeah, I think we can do the 8-bunk because we can get rid of the two essential, the non-essential people, which were groupies, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
usually it was, because most of all the buses were 12 bunk. That was, you know, 75% of them or more were 12 bunk buses. And then we had a few that were nine. We had, you know, a couple of 9 bunk. I mean, we had one or two, we always kept one or two around that were 15 bunk for Ronnie James Dio. And for Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton, they would, if they could have had 3 15 bunkers, they would have, because they brought, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to one of their shows, there's like, you know, 20 guys on stage.
Yeah.
And but most of them were that. And then we started the Star Bus that would usually only have, you know, have the big stateroom in the back. And then only have like three or four, it felt most time like 3 bunks. And that was just for the tour manager, you know, so a lot of those buses went that, or a lot of those tours went that way. It just depended on, you know, the size of the band and how much money they were making.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, do you remember the band Bush? Do you remember that band?
Mm-hmm.
We built them 2 custom buses because they wanted to sleep. They didn't want to sleep in motels. They wanted to sleep on the bus. So it had queen size. There were 4 queen size beds between 2 buses.
Huh.
Between 2 buses.
Uh-huh.
And they were laid out exactly the way they wanted. No, they used those buses for, gosh, almost a year, 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
and just toured incessantly. And it was, so we did that kind of thing sometimes.
So do you read the history about when they switched over from the, you know, the 40s big bands would be out in the standard regular Greyhound buses to mm-hmm. when it switched over to being essentially tour buses for bands and crews?
Yeah, you know, I've got some stuff on that buried away where, you know, that was back in the 70s, really, when it made that jump. Late 70s, I guess it would be. But there were still people doing, you know, mostly in the country side, because those guys generally toured the most. Mm-hmm. And so they would, you know, have a bus built. They were really kind of the originators of the modern tour bus.
Okay.
But I mean, I even remember one bus that, that had the hump and the, you know, it was like the old Greyhound bus,
but
it had the hump roof in the back.
Uh-huh.
And somebody had converted that completely into a tour bus. That was kind of weird.
Hmm. What manufacturers come to mind or what manufacturers were?
Obviously Eagle was, and it will always, my opinion is that Eagle was always the best bus. I mean, that's just a fine, awesome bus.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Prevost has now taken over. They pretty much they dominate the tour bus industry now.
Right.
But there was also the MCI.
Oh yeah,
that came about, and the Van Hool.
Okay.
Who's the other?
So every one of those went through certain stages of being more popular. Or I remember the Prevost, MCI, and the Eagle were. I know Prevost came a little later, didn't it?
It did, because I mean, when I came on the scene in '91, that's when I got the crash course. It was just Eagle. That's all. We were running at that point.
Did they call it the Silver Eagle, or was it just the Eagle?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Silver Eagle, they were built in Brownsville, Texas.
Huh.
And then Mexico bought it. I don't remember exactly what happened, but Mexico either bought an interest in it or something, so they started building them down there. But then Prevo came out with, their XL40, and... It was a nicer bus overall. And then the 45 came out, 45 footer, and that was, I guess, 93,
mm-hmm.
92 or 93. And I remember that they were illegal in California.
Yeah.
So we had to stage the 40-foot buses in the border towns on I-10 and I-5. Do you remember that?
Really?
And they had to switch everybody over. Yeah.
Interesting.
That was a pain in the butt.
I bet.
I mean, Phil even hired we hired a lobbyist to go to to get it changed.
And then it was changed.
Sacramento.
Then,
guess, right? Then they legalized them, and that was when I was there. I remember that was right when I came in, almost, is when the 45s became legal in California.
Huh.
So... There was no real 45. They were cutting and adding 5 feet. Is how they originally did that. Yeah.
Okay.
So the factory didn't start manufacturing them until, I guess, 93.
Okay.
That's when that was.
Wow. Interesting.
Because I have one bus. I got a picture of me and Dwight Yoakam, and that bus was the very first. I think of a very, very, very first Eagle 45-foot bus delivered. It was delivered.
Hmm.
And then, of course, Prevost did their 45, and that's where it all is now.
Yeah,
but,
okay. So The difference between the crew and the band, their schedules. The crew would, we'll describe that. They would basically
well, that's a good
point. Yeah, they'd sleep overnight while it's going, right? Pretty much.
Yeah, they would sleep during the drive. So your booking agent, you know, it's in his hand to route the tour. So it's reasonable, you know, to make it from city to city. And that can be tough. So, you know, then you got to skip a day and, in between travel, you have a travel day in, but yeah, they got, you know, the loadouts, I mean, your typical shed, you know, the typical shed tour, which would be the only ones with multiple buses. You know, we did obviously tons of bar tours. And that was usually just one bus. So everybody had to, you know, deal with it. And those generally stayed later too, before they loaded out. But generally the shed tour is over at 11 because of noise restrictions and in neighborhoods and all that mess. So 11 o'clock, the show's over, takes them 3 or 4 hours to tear everything down and pack it up and load it out. So, you know, they hit the road at 3 o'clock, and if they got to be at this next show, you know, next setup, they're going to be there at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, but the crew just goes right to the venue and park backstage and continue sleeping till it's stage call.
Okay, so you're saying the semi trucks are the ones that take off at the same time as the crew bus, but the
but the band bus, you know, usually would go ahead. I mean, a lot of times they like some bands want to always travel together, so I guess a lot of them did that way. But band and crew bus, but the band bus would generally go to the hotel. Because the you know, here again, it depends on the stature of the band. But you know, if it's a regular, if it's a shed tour, then it's pretty big stature. So they're going to go to their hotel and check in and get, you know, they're going to be there until sound check. And then usually the bus would come out. That's what the drivers always hated. The bus driver had to get up and drive the band over to the venue at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever, six, you know,
right.
That was always a pain in the butt for them because that's their time to sleep. So a lot of coordination.
Yeah.
The best deal was like, you know, that's the best way to tour, of course, is to me anyway, put all your crew on a bus, on the buses, and fly.
Mm-hmm.
The band, just fly the band.
Right. But it's so funny how I don't think one realizes how much grind it is for the crew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you start thinking you're tearing down a stage until 3 a.m. You're getting on a bus, albeit you do get used to sleeping over moving wheels and diesel engines. But at the same time, you know,
you're so tired.
It's a cat nap, really. It's like, because you're not, let's face it, you're not going right to the bunk as soon as you're getting on the bus because you're winding down from all the hoopla.
That's right.
And hoopla meaning, you know, when you do active work like that, start like coming off
you're
exercise.
On rigging
is what it is.
And all that.
Yeah,
yeah.
You got to wind down. So they're getting to sleep maybe 4 a.m. about the time sun's coming up. But of course their bunk is blacked out. You can black it out with curtains and everything. So then you're on the road for, I don't know, what would you say your average staging length is between average city, 400, 300 miles?
You know, the average was like 350.
Yeah.
You know, 300, 350 miles.
Yeah, so then you've got, what is that, hours is that on the road?
That's 8 hours.
8 hour road time. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So you're pulling in, you leave at 3, like you said, you're pulling in at, actually you're pulling in closer to probably 10 or 11.
Right.
But you're going right to the gig. You're not going to some comfy hotel.
Right. Nope.
Your hotel is the road, and forever when you're on the road.
You live in that thing. You live in it.
You're going right to the gig. And then, so do the semi-trucks pretty much show up at the same time, or what is that?
Usually they get in first because they got to, you know, we're still talking shed tour.
Yeah.
You know, they got to back in and, you know, back up to the stage and have everything ready to go. And then they take, you know, their gigs over till after the show. They go to their hotel and sleep and do whatever.
Do they go to the hotel to sleep, or does a lot of them just go ahead and sleep right there in their sleeper?
In the sleeper. Uh-huh. Some of them did. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A bunch of them would either go in the sleeper or go to the room. Those guys didn't, you know, the truck driver doesn't get paid with the bus driver. The bus driver always got, you know, the bigger paycheck. But expenses and everything. Well, band wanted to make sure he was, they want to, you take care of your bus driver. Mm-hmm. If you want to live through the end of the tour. But the crew guys, and then, you know, most all of the sheds, the big sheds have, you know, nice facilities for showering and, and catering. And,
of course, catering, sure.
Yeah, you're showing up. You wake up and you go have breakfast at the, you know, Joanne did that for a couple of years.
Right.
Here at the shed down here doing the catering that. And then she was shuttling the band from shuttling the bands from their hotel to the show and then back after the show.
Got it.
So that was, you know, that's another part of it.
So sticking with the crew, coming back to them, so they show up at 10 or 11 in the morning and the trucks are there. So they got to get out, and they might get a bite to eat or stretch or whatever, but they're going right into loading and rigging and spending another few hours setting up again, because at about 3 or 4 o'clock, here comes the band for a sound check.
Right.
What a
four or five,
life, huh?
Usually every. That's rough.
Jesus.
That's tough life right there. I mean, you're on a treadmill.
And you think about the people thinking, well, that's glamorous. You get to hang out with, you know, whatever, Bob's, you know, the big boys. Okay. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then you're thinking, those are the ones that really need to get the credit. But the band's off sleeping in a hotel until, what, 3 in the afternoon.
Right.
Oh.
But that's the way life is.
I know. it's just a trip, the whole thing. Well, let's pick it up next time, maybe more.
Okay.
You can think of some ideas that would work for your book, too. And you're welcome to have any of this stuff that sounds like
cool.
It could be incorporated with any of your audio editions.
That'd be cool. Yeah, I've got I still have a lot to go through that I need to unearth, and I keep remembering stuff, and I'm sitting here talking to you that, you know, kind of know where stuff is. So I need to go ahead and start doing that.
You tell me what you think when you kick it around some more, but come from the reader's standpoint, what would they really be interested in? Okay, they like to hear names and stuff and maybe some stories, but what would those stories be when it comes to strictly transportation, like we talked a little bit near the end there, you know, regarding the crew and the band, what more can we expand on there that would have them be a part of this whole story about, whoa, I didn't realize that took place, you know, as far as when they're moving around from city to city, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Gosh, I mean, It evolved a lot. It really did, huh? I mean, I remember when Phil had put, and this was right when I started working with him, he put payphones on the buses because there were no cell phones.
Yeah,
I mean, there were very few cell phones out there. There were payphones on the buses.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you could call home. no, I don't know. I mean,
yeah, that's a big part of it. You know, that stuff, really, definitely, we were in the business way before the internet.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of different sort of attributes.
I mean, and you were talking a little bit about the marketing. Before I forget this, you know, what I would do is I'd get a copy of the itinerary and do all the mileages so I could figure out, you know, where the overdrives would be and, you know, figure all that out and make up a budget on the computer and fax. We lived on fax machines back then.
Yep.
You know,
we
didn't have email or internet. So, you know, I'd fax it off and then they would approve it or we could negotiate it around a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then they would never sign it. I bet you I have about 10 signed contracts. I think I saved every one of those. Nobody ever signs their contract, but they would send the money and, you know, they make a deposit and we're off to the races.
Yeah. I assume you heard experience the same as I did on some occasions where I would have the plane in position waiting for the check to land via FedEx. I'd see the FedEx plane landing. It would taxi over. Uh-huh. We would go over to the FedEx depot, pick up the check, and then come back and start the first part of the tour.
Oh, wow. No, I never did that. I never went to that extreme. But
oh, it was like within hours. You're thinking, okay, we're not moving unless this check arrives here any minute. And there you see the plane coming in with your check on it. It's kind of funny.
Oh, wow. None. I mean, we'd roll buses without. I mean, it depends on the client, you know.
Yeah.
But we'd roll buses without getting paid, and then because we always figured it's a lot easier to just pull off into a rest area out in the middle of nowhere, you know, just find the most remote rest area along the way, and say we're not moving the bus until you call your CPA to cut us a check, wire transfer. Mm-hmm. Is actually where I'd drive around. But, you know, the good thing about being in LA is I could go by their offices and pick them up. I did that some.
There was one time, Bobby, when I did a trip for a prince of Saudi Arabia. He called me Saturday. This is here again back in the mid 80s, so it was way before the internet, and it couldn't do a wire transfer on a Saturday. So he sent an $80,000 check via, at that time they had what was called, I'm going to bastardize the nomenclature, but it's called desk to desk, something like that, where an airline would take a courier document and put it on a regular passenger airplane and fly it to the city where you could pick it up at the desk of the airline.
Huh.
And
news to me.
Well, it was kind of news to me until I kind of tried to research what the heck could I do, and I found that, so this guy, the Saudi guy was out of New York or something. I said, well, here's what you need to do. I was living in Big Bear at the time. You need to it's Saturday morning. He's going to take a trip starting Sunday afternoon. It's on his word to me that he's sending me a check for $80,000. And whether or not the check's good or not, I have no idea. And then I call my airline, I was using a DC-9, I think, for this trip. And I forget who the operator was. But I said, are you available? It's going to take off tomorrow, Sunday, and it's going to go for a week or something. And he goes, yeah, you know, your word is good. So when you get in the industry and people start saying your word is good, that gets scary because now I'm thinking, I hope this guy's check's good. Because it's one thing, it's your word's good that you're getting the plane, but it's another thing is I've never dealt with this guy before. So he arranged to have a courier take the $80,000 check, put it in the, American Airline flight, to Ontario, California.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to drive down the hill. It's, you know, like an hour and a half to Ontario, driving down the mountain. Picked up the check at like 5 in the afternoon from the counter. Counter to counter, that's what it was called, not desk to desk.
Oh, counter to counter, okay, yeah.
And got the check. It was written, I forget the guy's, Arab's name, you know, on the check, and $80,000. And I get on the phone immediately to the airline. I go, well, I'm going to go ahead and release you. Be here tomorrow at such and such a time. And the airline guy goes, okay, well, you, I expect that you're going to pay me come Monday or Tuesday. So I take the check into my bank on Monday. Here I am, you know, in the First Mountain Bank in Big Bear, and I knew the banker, but he wasn't there at the time. I took the check in, and I couldn't,
oh, no.
I couldn't deposit it right away because I needed his confirmation. And he and I had golfed with this guy before, so he was like a golfing buddy. So he would chuck and jive me, and he was laughing. I got him on the phone. I go, when are you coming into the bank? Because I need you to approve this $80,000 check. And he's going, what? Who's the check from? And I go, and I told him who it was. He's going, he started laughing and he started screwing with me. Like, I don't know if that thing's going to be any good. Oh, shit. And so,
oh, man.
You know, the plane had already taken off. It was already 2 days into the trip. And, so he gets to the bank and he calls me. He's going, you better come in here right now. And he just fucking freaked me out. He just, I drive into the bank and he closes, he pulls me into his office like it's a big deal. He closes the door and he tells the secretary, don't let anyone bother us for, you know,
I'm
thinking, oh,
here you go.
What? Now he's going to tell me this is a fraudulent check, you know? And all of a sudden he goes, well, I'm sorry I fucked with you so much, but not only is this check good, the guy that wrote the check owns the bank.
I think it's good.
So, you know, but
oh, wow.
Here you are, at the, you know, you're kind of going through your career thinking, well, this could be it.
This you're
might
right.
Not fly. I might be working at Bob's or McDonald's to pay off this $80,000 after this. You know.
Oh, man. Hey, what airport did you fly in and out of Ontario when you were out at Big Bear, or where did you?
Well, the
airport.
You mean as far as when I flew personally?
When you flew, or were you flying? You weren't flying back at that point, huh?
Yeah, probably.
You did. You flew... like Jerry Garcia, I know that.
Yeah,
like that.
But that was
at
a brokerage point at that time.
Okay.
So I wasn't personally flying any more bands or entertainers. I was mostly from, I would say, probably the early 80s on, I was doing mostly brokerage work. I would sit in on a plane for, you know, first officer or sit in a right seat to complement the two-pilot requirement. But for the most part, after the first 5 years, which was 76 through early 80s, that would be about it. My flying days, actually flying entertainers. Then I got into the babysitting role, like, you know, professional babysitters that we were handling all the documentation and paper shuffling and communication with the road manager daily and communication with the CPA when that time came to get the transfer of your next set of funds and negotiating the contracts with the attorneys on the prior to the tour and on and on and on. So, I was flying small aircraft out of the Big Bear Airport all the time.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I remember another trip I did for Hart. I was flying out of Big Bear. I had a little Tiger aircraft. It was a Grumman Tiger. It was a four-place, something comparable to like a Piper Arrow.
Okay.
And I had, because I was training flight use of planes because I still did some light maintenance, technical, you know, inspections for owners of aircraft. And so I would have use of aircraft that way. And I remember, speaking of the FedEx example of waiting for the check to arrive, I remember being in L.A. The HART tour was going to start in 2 days. I was dealing contracts with the attorneys out of Seattle, because they're out of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that there was a conflict with a time to get the contracts together and the funding together in time for the tour to start. And I just said, fuck it, I'm flying to Seattle in this little plane to sit down with the attorneys and get this thing done. And so I flew in there one afternoon, and it was funny because the attorney goes, I knew you said you're going to be here, but I didn't realize you're going to fly up your own little plane. I go, well, I couldn't get, the airlines were, I couldn't get it booked right at the right time. And I just said, screw it, I'm coming up. And he just got a chuckle out of the fact that I'd fly in a small plane to take care of the contract. So,
that's pretty cool.
Pretty funny stuff. But we've got more to tell. So
I appreciate
your time. And
the more
start
we talk about it, the more.
Huh? Yeah.
The more I remember, I just need to start taking more notes.
Yeah.
And, we'll just a few minutes ago, my guy called. I don't know what he's got for me, but could very well be up there.
But you don't want to come up for a few days, because that storm's going to be hitting tomorrow, and you don't want to come up in the next couple of days. You'll be right in the middle of it.
Yeah. It probably won't be, I would guess, the soonest in about 7 days.
Yeah. Okay.
It could be months. I fly back and forth. I get, I work at my own pace and be, and like that. So I won't have to stay up there the entire time. I'll get breaks to the house. It could be the Superstorm Sandy. It's still on. I mean, they're still working on lawsuits and all kinds of things. But it went on for the average adjuster year and a half.
Wow.
But I don't think this one's quite that bad from what you're telling me.
Yeah, well,
what I'm seeing.
It's hard to say. It's funny. Some of the stuff they predict pretty good, and some other stuff, I've noticed you're so much on the line of whether or not you're on the freeze point or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between the rain and the snow, you could get, you could go down the street a few miles and they've got an extra foot of snow where it ended up raining mostly. So it's the microclimate is kind of interesting around here for sure, but it's really no different than parts of like living in Colorado or that I experienced, where you could drive down the street and you're in New Mexico and you're playing golf the same day that there's 2 feet, just
in
35 minutes. Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of no different in that regard. It does look like it's got the potential to mess things up. Last one was kind of interesting. The one that just happened a few days ago, it really wasn't much, but just kind of a rain storm here. But on the coast, is interesting because I noticed one of the houses that I stayed at for a few days with my daughter and her hubby, they had rented right on the beach there in a place called Scituate, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
And they've got a seawall there. And I was just, it was just weird because when I got there, I remember seeing the tide was up and it was a little choppy and it was halfway up the seawall. I'm thinking, man, this must get nasty when the waves are breaking over that seawall. I mean, because the deck's right there. You're right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed those images of the waves just going crest.
Over
they hit
the
seawall to just go over the top of a 3-story building.
Yeah.
And that would have been so freaky to be in that house and see that those waves come in and just go, oh, man. If that thing would have had any sort of debris, logs, rocks, or whatever, they'd be busting out those windows.
Right.
It'd be freaky.
I mean, and they're showing pictures, I think it is in Scituate where there's the rocks have just, like the whole bottom of the ocean just washed on shore. I mean, it's just all huge rocks and completely impassable.
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm, and it's, it, it, the deal I'm working, I try to work on as much as possible. It's kind of the easiest for the most money, I guess, honestly, what it is, is these NFIP, you know,